Thank you. That was very nice.
Thank you.
So hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Yes? Good. So I'm very thrilled to be here with you tonight and to be back again to be with you. I want to honor you as longtime peace activists. I'm a longtime peace activist myself. I think I went to my first peace rally in 1960 or 61 as a college student in New York City at a Ban the Bomb demonstration when we were supposed to go underground. You remember those days? And active protest people refused to go underground. And that was the beginning of my activism for peace, and I've been involved in the peace movement ever since. So I congratulate all of you for your good work. And I especially want to congratulate you for linking all these issues, especially the issue of peace and climate change, which is what I'm going to talk about tonight. These are the two most pressing issues of our time, and as I will argue, they are intricately linked. The more we can highlight these the linkages, I believe, the better our chances of achieving progress on both. That's what I want to try to demonstrate tonight. Now, I think you all know that government officials from all over the world will be converging in Paris in a few weeks, beginning on November 30th, for a pivotal conference on climate change, probably the most important, most pivotal conference ever held on the environment. Officially, this is called the 21st Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP21. And you're going to be hearing a lot about this in the weeks to come. Now, this conference is being billed as a climate or an environmental conference, a meeting intended to address climate risks. But I hope to demonstrate tonight that it is also a peace conference, perhaps one of the most important peace conferences in human history. If it succeeds, we could avoid a global epidemic of resource wars. If it fails, the world will get hotter, both in climate terms and in military terms. Now, as you probably know, the stated goals of COP21 is to adopt a series of measures, country by country, that will prevent global greenhouse gases emissions from reaching a level that would cause the Earth to warm no more than 2 degrees centigrade on average. That's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the maximum amount that scientists agree the Earth can absorb without triggering cataclysmic climate effects, such as the melting of the Greenland and Antarctica ice sheets, which, if they do melt, will cause a sea level rise of 10 to 20 meters, potentially wiping out cities like New York and Washington and Philadelphia, Baltimore, Miami, and many other cities around the world. Now, before I go any further with this, let me point out that many scientists, including James Hansen of Columbia University, who we just heard about from Catherine, believe that a temperature increase of even 1 degree centigrade, or about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit average increase, will result in cataclysmic climate events. And in fact, we're very close to that already. The Earth has warmed approximately 0.8 degrees centigrade since the beginning of the Industrial Age. And we're already beginning to see early warning signs of catastrophic tipping points. I wrote about that recently in an article for TomDispatch.com, and I researched this and events that scientists thought might happen after 2050 or at the end of the century are beginning to happen now. By tipping points, I mean not a linear increase in temperature and the like, something that we could adjust to gradually, but sudden breaks in the routine, dramatic irreversible events that have cascading effects that would be devastating for humans and all other creatures on the planet, such as the slowing of the Gulf Stream, which would cause, as you can imagine, vast weather changes in North America, Eastern North America, and Europe, and so forth. The melting of the Arctic ice cap, which would remove a reflecting lens that of white that sends heat back into the atmosphere. If that melts, the Earth will absorb much more solar radiation, accelerating the pace of climate change. We're beginning to see the melting of permafrost in the far north, and that contains a lot of methane, so that would be released into the atmosphere, speeding up the pace of climate change. And we're seeing the dying out of the Amazon, something that nobody thought was possible. And that too would have follow-on effects around, certainly in Latin America, with the drought that's hit a lot of Brazil. So these effects are already in evidence, and that's with a temperature increase of only 0.8 degrees centigrade. It's already probably too late to stop some of these calamities from occurring, but it's not too late to stop warming from reaching beyond 2 degrees centigrade. And once that barrier is crossed, it will become almost impossible to prevent these catastrophic events and far greater calamities from occurring. Hence, it is absolutely essential that delegates at the Paris Climate Summit succeed in adopting measures that will continue global warming to a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius. And we could talk afterwards about what's likely to happen there. If they fail to do so, and there's no guarantee of success, we're not likely to have another opportunity like this anytime soon. This would mean, in all likelihood, that we'll continue to pour out greenhouse gases at an ever-increasing rate, as we have been doing for the past decades. And the planet will shoot well beyond 2 degrees centigrade increase to 3 degrees, 4 degrees, or even more. And scientists tell us that the effects of this will be absolutely cataclysmic. It's painful to even imagine what that would mean, what a world like that would mean, especially if you have children or grandchildren, as I know many of you do, or if you work with children or young people in some capacity, like teaching or as caregivers. I'm teaching a class now at Hampshire College, where I work, on climate change effects to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. And it horrifies me to talk with them about the literature that we're reading. We're reading the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC reports, on these kind of predictions of what we could expect in the second half of the century, when they will be mature adults and maybe having children of their own. These projections indicate that many areas of the United States will be suffering from perpetual drought and wildfires like those we saw this summer in California and the Pacific Northwest, and from recurring storms and flooding, like that we saw with Hurricane Sandy, and now Hurricane Patricia that hit yesterday in the west coast of Mexico. But I want to say that that is to say my American students, are going to be privileged compared to others on the planet in 2050, in all likelihood, in this regard. I shudder to think about the future that my students from Africa and the Middle East and Asia will face in the decades ahead. According to the IPCC, these areas will face extreme water scarcity, recurring crop failures, habitat collapse, and even higher temperatures than we will face in North America, leading to state collapse, starvation, and mass migrations. So the conference in Paris is absolutely pivotal in determining if we will be able to keep global warming at a level that most humans can survive, or if it will move into the realm where the survival of many populations and societies can no longer be taken for granted. And this is why I say that the Paris Climate Summit is not just an environmental conference, but also a peace conference. Because a failure in Paris would mean not only environmental catastrophe, but also chaos, instability, desperation, and war. On the other hand, success in Paris could lay the groundwork for progress in achieving greater world peace. Let me explain all this a bit further. If you read the most recent report of the IPCC, specifically the report of Working Group 2, there are three working groups, one on the science of climate change, one on mitigation, that is what we have to do to prevent things from getting beyond 2 degrees, and one on impacts, vulnerabilities, and adaptation. That's Working Group 2. That looks at what this will mean to human civilizations. And if you read that report, you will find that the likely impacts of climate change include not just floods, storms, droughts, and wildfires, and coastal flooding, but also wars, riots, and battles over vital resources. The reason for this is threefold. First, I don't think I have to tell you. The world is already bitterly divided along lines of race, class, ethnicity, religion, language, and caste. Wherever you look, societies are being riven by antagonisms between people of different groups, however defined, whether they be Shiites and Sunnis, Arabs and Jews, Hindus and Muslims, Catholics and Protestants, and so on. You just have to pick up the daily newspaper, something I force myself to do every day, and if you dare, to see that this is so. There are many reasons for this, of course, including the legacies of colonialism, failed post-colonial states, global economic inequity, mass youth unemployment, and so on. These problems have been growing more intense in recent years and only seem to be growing stronger with the years. Secondly, many of these schisms would be there even without climate change. Second, many of these schisms coincide with differences in access to the vital necessities of life: food, water, land, housing, health care, etc., with some groups enjoying greater access to the vital necessities and those and other groups enjoying access to less. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, for example, which has been heating up in recent weeks, as you know, is driven by deep-seated religious and ethnic hostilities. But it is also driven by fights over land and water, with the Palestinians experiencing far more deprivation in this regard than the Israelis. The same is true of many of the other disputes we see in the world today. In Iraq, the Sunnis enjoyed privileged positions under Saddam Hussein, and now under the Shiite leadership are being denied access to vital resources. And so it's no wonder that many of them have joined with ISIS. You see this in all of the conflicts we're seeing around the world, that the divides along racial and ethnic lines also coincide with differentiated access to the vital necessities of life. And needless to say, the struggle for vital resources and a perception that one's rivals or oppressors are enjoying better access to these vital resources adds enormous fuel to these already existing antagonisms, increasing the risk of armed violence. And then third, add in the third factor to this, climate change will accentuate these resource differentials, imposing greater pain and hardship on some communities than on others. You know, greater harm falling typically on those that are already suffering the most. And this, in turn, will increase the sense of deprivation and desperation among those most affected. Groups that already suffer from an inadequate access to food, water, and shelter will find their access even further curtailed, increasing their fury. Now, let me be clear about this. Everybody will suffer from climate change, especially if warming exceeds 2 degrees centigrade. But these hardships will not be distributed evenly. Some people will suffer more than others. And when the divide between those who suffer more and those who suffer less coincides with existing racial, ethnic, and religious schisms, the likelihood of violent conflict goes way up. To fully appreciate this, you have to understand that climate change is essentially a resource catastrophe. Yes, I know it's going to damage the environment and threaten all kinds of species that have been on the planet for a very long time, but from a human perspective, what climate change is going to do is to degrade and destroy the vital resources on which we all depend, especially land, food, and water. These will become more scarce and more degraded as climate change proceeds. Think of Kenya, Nigeria, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Nigeria, where various tribes and communities have long been fighting over control of the best watered, most fertile land. Typically, the most powerful and politically connected tribes and groups have occupied the most desirable land, forcing less powerful and less well-connected groups to survive in less desirable, less watered lands. As the planet warms, climate change will pose a threat to all farmlands in Africa and elsewhere, but those already water scarce will become water deprived, making human survival nearly impossible in many areas. Those occupying these now parched landscapes will be forced to abandon their homeland, either to invade and conquer less impacted neighboring lands, or to move to cities in other countries where they are sure to face hostility and violence from those already residing there. This is already occurring across a broad swath of sub-Saharan Africa known as the Sahel, the southern fringe of the Saharan Desert, where spreading desertification is forcing Muslim herders to migrate south into farmlands occupied by Christians and animists, producing wars in half a dozen countries, including Mali, Niger, Sudan, Nigeria, and Somalia. The same pattern is being seen in North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. Now, typically, these wars are described in the media as ethnic and religious wars because the parties to conflict are organized by tribe and religion and are rallying around the sectarian appeals of their demagogic leaders. At heart, however, these are climate wars, because the fuel for combat is competition over the vital resources made scarce by climate change. As the planet warms and more resources become scarce and degraded, the risk of resource-driven conflict is bound to increase, sweeping from Africa and the Middle East to the rest of the planet. And so this is why I say the Paris Climate Conference is also a peace conference. If we could limit the increase in global temperatures to 2 degrees centigrade, or hopefully less, we vastly diminish the risk that the world will plunge into an endless nightmare of climate-driven resource wars. In sum, every fraction of a degree, less temperature increase we succeed in achieving is a critical step towards reducing the risk of global bloodshed. That is why I view the Paris Climate Summit as a peace conference. But there's another reason why we could view this conference as a peace conference. That's because it will only succeed if every nation on Earth, and especially the major industrial powers, the United States, China, Russia, the European Union countries, Japan, India, Brazil, Indonesia, and so on, agree on a common framework for reducing the emission of greenhouse gases and on ensuring the full implementation of promises made in Paris. Every country has to agree to do their part to keep temperatures below 2 degrees. This means that countries that are not especially friendly to each other, the US and Russia, the US and China, India and China, and so on, must cooperate with one another in reaching a successful conclusion. If they allow their current disagreements, and there are plenty of those, to intrude into the proceedings, the conference will fail, and we will all be condemned to a climate-altered world. They must cooperate for our mutual well-being. And bear in mind, we're talking about measures that will impose significant restrictions on the energy systems and economic behavior of all these countries, something never before attempted in human history. All the countries who agree to this, if they do, are going to have to alter how they produce energy and how their economies are going to be run. That means the US and China and Russia all have to cooperate in this endeavor. For this to work, all of the countries will need to continue working together year after year in a cooperative manner in order to ensure that the adopted measures are fully carried out. This means that whatever their attitudes towards one another, they must collaborate on very critical matters with continuous follow-up sessions, procedures, meetings, and so on. If the process works well, we could see a new era of international cooperation. If it breaks down, not only will we experience a more climate-destroyed planet, but a world of increased international tension and hostility. In this sense, collaboration in slowing climate change may prove to be the best opportunity we will ever have to ensure international cooperation and peace. In fact, if it succeeds, the Paris climate could prove to be as momentous as the San Francisco Peace Conference of 1945, which established the United Nations. That's what's at stake in this meeting. It is essential, then, that we do everything we can to make it succeed. We have about 5 weeks left. And not only that, even if it succeeds, there will be many in this country and others in other countries who will work to sabotage the agreements, either for ideological reasons or because they have a vested interest in perpetuating the fossil fuel industries responsible for climate change. All the Republican candidates for president, so far as I could see, fall into this category. Accordingly, we will have a long march ahead of us, and Catherine gave us our marching orders, and we have a lot of work to do to resist efforts to undermine any progress achieved in Paris and to ensure the full implementation of its accords. But to conclude, I believe that such efforts will represent a worthy continuation of all the work you and our allies have done all these years in the pursuit of international peace and cooperation. This could prove to be one of the most momentous, important events in human history. So we have hope as well as dread as we look into the future. And I'll end with that thought. So thank you very much.
We'll get some Q&A going. Is there another microphone up here?
So now I'm really eager to get your feedback on this and to question me about anything I said. I'm really eager to hear your thoughts about all of this. Now I'm going to get to see you a little bit better.
I don't think we have enough dialogue about the issues of farming.
And of what farming?
Farming. And methane gas.
I'm sympathetic. Who is the person who spoke? I can't see. Oh, okay. Thank you for bringing that up. Listen, I believe you're raising an important point, but according to the IPCC, about 3/4 of the greenhouse gases come from the burning of fossil fuels and related industries. Farming is maybe 10 to 15%, and deforestation by burning is the rest. So, well, farming is important, and there's a lot we could do to reduce the methane released in farming. We're not going to get there if we don't tackle fossil fuel combustion.
Climate change is occurring.
My belief is that there's no such thing as denial. There are people who, for political reasons, ideological reasons, or selfish reasons, choose to finance a professional class of denialists who profit from this activity. But I don't think that there are people anymore who are true denialists. So we know, for example, in the past few weeks, investigators have, through careful search, have found out that ExxonMobil knew 20 years ago, their scientists told them that climate change is real, that it's caused by humans, and that it's going to have these effects, and that ultimately they're going to have to stop burning fossil fuels, and they chose to suppress that information and went on saying there's no such thing as climate change. But that was profit-driven activity, not because they didn't believe. They knew. And I think that's true of all of these companies. They know. They just have selfish or political reasons for doing so. Now, some of this is ideological, because the president, who's a Democrat, who they hate and despise, is in favor of taking action on climate change. So anything that he says, they say the opposite. This is a kind of pathology. It's pathological. But I don't think that it's actually denial in the sense that it's something else. It's a pathology, not denial. That's my view.
You spend a lot of time speaking about the Paris Peace Conference. What can we do to help promote it? What can we do to try to slow down the process of deforestation that's going on?
The deforestation is mainly occurring in other parts of the world, in Brazil, in Indonesia, in Southeast Asia. There's a lot that we could do to stop it, but it's sort of a distant activity. I think to stop that, we have to provide funds for those countries to preserve their forests. They have to have incentives, like, for example, creating peace parks, which some people are promoting. In other words, to give them economic incentives not to burn down the forests, but to keep them intact. So there's a lot that groups around the world are doing, NGOs are doing, to try to stop deforestation. I'll get to your first question in a minute. Something else to bear in mind is that a lot of the deforestation is being done to grow palm oil for biodiesel. And so we have to be very careful about, you know, presumably is a green fuel. So we have to be very careful that the promotion of biodiesel is not accompanied by deforestation. And this is especially true in Europe. And so European activists are trying to prevent that from happening. Now, your first question, what can we do about the conference? So there will be probably the biggest civil disobedience, biggest marches in the history of Europe on November 29th, I believe, the Sunday before the conference begins. And they are asking people around the world to have marches and rallies in support of their work. So there should be a local activities to in solidarity with the activists who are gathering from all over Europe in Paris on that day. I think a lot of education can be done. I know there are probably a lot of activities in Chicago being planned to educate people about the importance of this conference. And we're going to have to put pressure on our politicians. We don't have to work on the American delegation, because the American delegation is going to have the support of the president, and he's in favor of an agreement. The problem will be if they do reach an agreement and efforts will be made to sabotage it in the Congress of the United States. That's when you're really going to have to get down to work. Prevent sabotage.
My concern is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But if there are some things in that agreement that might go against what happens in Paris, do you have any clue for that?
I don't have a clue, in part because the negotiations have been kept secret and we don't know the content of the agreements. There are people working very hard on this to try to oppose it. Labor unions in particular, environmental organizations are working very hard on it. I share your concern. I'm afraid that's not something that I follow in detail, so I can't say. But I was educated this week. We had a speaker at my college in Smith College, Susan George. Some of you may know Susan George. Came from Paris telling us about what they're doing there, but she said, don't only worry about the TPP. There's also something called the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is bigger than the TPP, which is U.S. and Europe, which she says is equally or even worse when it comes to these things. So the Europeans are organizing around that, but she pleaded with us to take that one on as well.
So I think we were all worried about climate change before your talk. Now I'm really scared. So there were a lot of ifs leading up to this Paris conference. Do you have any thoughts on how things may play out?
This is a struggle that we all share. And as I said in my remarks, especially when I'm with people who are going to be around in 50 years or so, some of you in the room may be, I don't expect to be, we have to mix the hope with the despair. So in the case of the Paris talks, I'm reasonably optimistic. There will be an agreement. I'm reasonably optimistic that it will be a pretty good outcome. I have to say, we should have some admiration for our president, President Obama, because he understood that this would not work unless he got China on board. And, you know, that's why I say this is a peace process as well as an environmental process, because we're not getting along with China on other issues. But he made it a priority to bring China into this conversation. And he got a pledge from China to come to Paris with a promise to agree to take steps to make it possible. So that gives us hope that something will occur. He's also put a lot of pressure on the number three country in this regard, which is India, because India is now soon will be the third biggest emitter of carbon dioxide, and therefore will be increasingly bad in the future. And Prime Minister Modi happens to be a real problem. He wants to build more coal plants, so President Obama has worked very hard on him. And he's made some headway. So this is the best of the best. This is something we should honor the president for. So I think there's reasons to be hopeful. I'll tell you, my impression is that what will be achieved will be not enough to keep warming below 2 degrees centigrade, although it will be the best agreement ever reached before. Remember that the last time people agreed was the Kyoto Protocol. That was 20 years ago, and that excluded India and China and the developing countries. This one is all-inclusive. Everybody has to agree. So that's progress. I don't think they're going to make the 2-degree limit this time around. So the key thing to be looking at is the follow-up. Will there be a requirement that this be reviewed year after year, that the measures have to be ratcheted up as the temperature warms? If that's the case, this could prove to be a milestone in human history. That's why I say this will be the center of activity, the center of our work, I believe, in the years ahead. So thank you for asking that.
And I'm wondering if you could give a couple of examples at least of more local actions.
Thank you for asking that. And I will accept criticism for not doing more of that. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. So I'm trying to watch for that as best I can. But there is a lot happening, and probably it's more at local level than at national level. So California, I don't know if you're following California, is moving as if the federal government doesn't exist and is adopting... I don't know why this comes in and out. Should I use this?
Why don't we do that?
Hello? Okay. California is acting, they've put in place measures so that California will abide by the 2-degree limit in terms of restricting emissions, promoting and providing incentives for green technology. And they now have, under Governor Brown, a green foreign policy. Like I say, they're acting as if the federal government doesn't exist. So they have established a cap and trade program with British Columbia. They're negotiating with Quebec and Ontario, as well as other states of the Union, to participate in their climate change control program. That is a very positive sign. And it's important to highlight that because the denialists, so-called, all say, and the Republican candidates all say that the measures that President Obama favors will hurt the economy. You know, they call these a job-killing activities. But California is actually doing very well economically, even though it has the strictest emissions control in the United States. So we have to highlight that the greener you are, my state, Massachusetts, is also very high on that list, and our economy is doing very well. to highlight the fact that embracing green technology is a positive for the economy. And those states that are adhering to coal and oil are doing very badly. And those that different those differences will increase over time. But in addition to that, wherever you look, there are towns that are adopting, you know, local communities that are embracing, sometimes they're called transition towns, to reduce their footprint. And now colleges and universities are doing that. My college is going to become 100% solar powered in the next year. And we're growing our own food. And more colleges are doing this. So the Sierra Club magazine each September publishes a guide to the coolest colleges. So if you have children or grandchildren thinking of looking at college, get that issue instead of the U.S. News and World Report. And it ranks colleges by their commitment to green technology, to eliminating carbon. And it's now becoming a race to be on the top of that list. So those are some examples. Thank you.
A few weeks ago, the governor of the Bank of England addressed members of Lloyd's in London, where real money exists and yes. People who invest in the future of infrastructures on this planet. He told them that systemic risk was so great that they needed to abandon fossil fuels pretty rapidly. Are you familiar with that? And can you comment on what you think its effects will be? How? And then the last thing, are you familiar with Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Center in England and his talks on Towards Zero Carbon and the absolute necessity to immediately reduce the use of energy on the demand side while the politicians argue about how to address it on the supply side?
I'm not familiar with that. About the head of the Bank of England, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, or whatever his formal title. Yes, he said that simply as a matter of risk. If you're a prudent banker or investor, you have to worry about risk, and the risk from climate change was growing exponentially. Hence, if you were wise, you would do everything you could to minimize your exposure to climate change, which means the countries should do everything they can to curb their fossil fuel consumption and switch to renewables. But he spoke in particular about the insurance industry, as you said, because he calculated that the insurance industry will go bust in another decade or so because of the magnitude of storm damage and fire damage and the like. And this has created a ruckus in England because he's part of the Conservative government, which is made up of people who are anti-climate action. Cameron's government is of pro-fracking and anti-wind power and solar power. So it really has created quite a ruckus, and the good effect is that it is adding more momentum to the divestment movement, and more large pension funds and investment funds are taking their money out of fossil fuels. So it's having a very positive effect. I'm glad you're asking me all these questions. The more, the better.
There are those who want to continue business as usual. But there's signs of changes. And I think about all this turmoil. The answer is quite simple. We're going to have to live differently. And this is just the beginning. It's a horse and buggy era of the solar age.
Thank you for that. I couldn't agree more. I want to say in answer to what you said and to the last question is to appreciate the international nature of this effort. Even if our country succeeded with everything that President Obama wants us to do, you know, and the Netherlands and Denmark join us, it's not going to stop climate change. So that's why I emphasize the importance of this conference in Paris, because it's the only venue that we know of where all the countries of the world are coming together and where there is an effort to get everybody on board. That is the only thing that's going to work, is international cooperation. So that's why I put so much emphasis on that tonight. But I agree with your sentiment.
In your opinion, does nuclear power have any role to play in reducing carbon emissions while we transition to
Well, now, this is about nuclear power, and I've read the technical reports from the International Energy Agency, the IEA in Paris, which is the leading think tank of the industrialized nations. It's not an environmental organization. And they advocate nuclear power as an option, but they say that make the progress that we need to make, nuclear power can only provide a small fraction, a wedge, they call it, of the transition that's necessary, and it's too slow because of all the problems with nuclear power, the permitting for it, the problem with disposal of the radioactive wastes. That it's expensive to get started, but it takes a very long time. It takes 10 to 15 years to just break ground and another 15 years to complete a plant, so that in those 30 years before a plant comes online, we have to move much more swiftly than that. So yes, it might have a wedge role in some countries, a wedge by meaning, you know, if you eliminate fossil fuels, you're going to have to replace it with stuff. So some is wind, some is solar, geothermal, wave power, and the nuclear power and hydropower will all be wedges. But nuclear is not going to be a large wedge.
It's hard to have a national conversation about issues of importance like this. So I think we need to get the media. So did the Defense Department ever get behind climate change and these issues?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, certainly what you say about the media is critical. And I know you try to work on the media, and this is something that has to be a multi-generational effort, because I know from conversations with my students that they don't read the things that I read. They get everything off the internet. And you know, in Twitter and all of that, Facebook. So I'm sure you're trying to reach people and that those media as well. And it's crucial to operate at every level to educate people. So that's one point. The Defense Department is very interesting. If there were senior, I spoke this year at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. And I didn't give the same speech, but I made some of the same points. And there was total agreement with everything I said, because they understand that the world that I described is the world in which the cadets are going to be on ships dealing with these crises. And they told me they believe that they're going to spend their time in humanitarian missions or policing failed states because of climate change and resource catastrophe. So they understand completely everything that I told you tonight. And they're deeply troubled by this. And I've spoken to senior military officers, and they believe that this is the world in which they're going to have to operate. And therefore, the military is ahead of every other government agency in terms of planning for this world, in terms of being able to operate. You know, so there's a good side and a bad side to everything. The good side is that they're pioneering new technologies that could be available in the civilian sector. They're moving for, you know, they're building ships and planes that could fly with biofuels, algae-produced biofuels. That might someday be prove very useful. You know, on the other hand, they want to develop these systems so they could fight wars in the future, even when oil is not available. So that's the story about the Defense Department. They take climate change very, very seriously, and they see a world in which U.S. allies, I name some of them, Kenya, Nigeria, are likely to be failed states, and they may be sent there, you know, in humanitarian or police operations. Oh, by the way, this is the Navy, and most major U.S. naval bases are going to be underwater by the end of this century. So they are very aware that their whole operating system is at risk.
This is an academic question, but a real purpose to an academic. Let's see how we're going here. I've been working on the climate issue since 1988, so the last
way ahead of me.
So the academic question is this. A lot of work has been put in on the technologies, the parts per million, the science, hard sciences. I don't know that enough effort has been put in properly in the social science sector. Sociology, the new geography, social psychology. And one of the most influential books on this whole issue of climate for me was Jared Diamond's book.
Jared Diamond.
Collapse.
Yes.
It was in two parts. The first part was a whole series of societies which were in the prime of health, going great, and suddenly fell apart. We don't hear about them anymore. Second half of the book, though, were success stories. Societies that confronted literally life-threatening conditions and somehow got through it. The question, here's the word to the question, is are you aware of in academia or even at the IPCC of the social science people coming together to examine the meta-conditions that resulted in the failures, the ones that got the other societies through to the other side, and are those applicable to, you know, planetary destruction?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I mean, in the IPCC report, the volume that I identified has a chapter on human security that addresses this question, social science. And they refer to the failed states that you refer to, the Mayans, the Anasazi of American Southwest, and others. I use that book in my class. So, and we're in the middle of it now. And here's what I found. Maybe I should have talked more about this. Here's what I found in the book and in the social science research. Societies that work together, where people rally in the face of adversity across class lines, across race lines, across ethnic lines, that rally in the face of adversity survive. Societies that break apart, where the factions, different factions, fight with one another in the face of adversity, collapse. Human solidarity or social solidarity is the clue to survival and success. And there are contemporary examples of this. It's just interesting. There are contemporary examples of this. New Orleans collapsed. New Orleans was a failed society, as far as I'm concerned. Now it's somewhat revived, but not the New Orleans that was there, and it failed because the society did not rally. There was no social solidarity, and that's why it's a failed state. But there are other cases, similar cases, where the people all came together in the face of adversity and survived. So that is the clue, social solidarity in the face of adversity. And that's what we have to promote, and it has to go across all of these lines. That's why I emphasize that climate change is going to make that hotter, because people who are already divided are going to be further divided. Hence, working across those lines is absolutely crucial. And there is discussion of that in the IPCC report. Very good question you raise, and it's going to make me think more about that.
Do you mean that the world has failed because the rest of the society is not supporting the world, but the world has failed internally as their own society?
I'm saying that societies like the Mayans collapsed because the elites insisted on perpetuating their privileged lifestyle at the expense of the rest of the population. They went on building palaces through deforestation, by fighting wars for glory, even as conditions were deteriorating, rather than altering their behavior and working with the poor people and the peasants in their society to adapt to changing climate conditions. So, and the same thing happened to the Anasazi. So if you have societies where the elites or the ruling class or whatever you want to call them act for their own self-interest at the expense of everybody else, what that typically leads to is revolt, internal civil warfare, and collapse. The societies that succeeded, that Jared Diamond talks about, Tikopia, the New Guinea Highlands, are places where the elites collaborated with everybody else to adopt measures in which nobody was privileged and everybody shared in the hardship, but they survived. Is that clear? That's a sign of hope.
Native American, they have the answers, and we have to listen to them and work with them instead of against them, and how we mistreated them in the past in our history. And we will have the answers there, I believe.
Thank you.
What do you think about that?
Jared Diamond has written a book, the same Jared Diamond has written a book about what we could learn from indigenous peoples around the world. So he would certainly agree with you. And Naomi Klein, in her book, has highlighted the leadership role that Native societies in the U.S. and Canada have played in fighting against the worst effects of climate change. So I completely agree with you.
When we talk about war, looking at the history of the 20th century, the major wars were between countries. And, you know, whether it's, you know, China building islands in South China Sea or Russia, you know, say on bases in Syria, there are a number of indicators that there might be conflict between the big players. I wonder what you think the relationship of that is to.
I've trying to think about that a lot. So that's a very good question. Will countries go to war in a world of 2050, in a climate ravaged world? My feeling is that the risk of that is low. Partly because the military forces that they would usually have at their disposal to fight wars somewhere else are all going to be repurposed for humanitarian rescue, for crisis relief, and to protect borders against masses of migrants. To maintain order in countries that are going to face collapse and disintegration. So, you know, you're not going to have mass armies available and the money to pay for them to go to war on a large scale. That's my suspicion. Now, there were some caveats to that, but I don't know how far down the path of gloomy thinking you want me to go. I highlighted water as a crucial issue in all of this, and I do worry about wars over water. Between India and China, for example, over the headwaters of the rivers that they share is a possibility. There are other places where Egypt might go to war. They've threatened to go to war with Ethiopia, is now building a dam that would divert water from the Nile. So I do worry about wars over water, but those are what I call resource wars. But the other kind of wars, I'm not so sure. But we're guessing. I suspect the U.S., I just think, you know, in the current crisis in Europe, what are they talking about? They're talking about using their navy to stop people from crossing the Mediterranean and using their troops to keep people from crossing from Turkey into Greece. That's the future. So they won't have armies available for international adventures. Let me just see what.
One more. One more question. We don't want to keep you all night. I know we could go on forever.
But I'm learning. Well, he's had his hand up. This gentleman.
We haven't addressed the issue of population control.
Population.
Voluntary or incentives. And the other, the other thing is I have a different take on Jared Diamond's book, that the success story is the most significant, where dictators essentially had mandated environmental protections. Green concentration of power might be what people would argue would be necessary for this type of global crisis.
Yeah, well, I've just read the Japan chapter for the umpteenth time a week ago, so... It was a top-down case. This is the Tokugawa period of Japan, from the 1600s to about 1850, and that was a top-down rule. But it was a rule in which there was a high degree of social cohesion, because everybody within that society was guaranteed the minimum requirements to have an adequate lifestyle. So you didn't have, and it prohibited elites, including the shogun, from excessive consumption. There were limits on consumption. So yes, it was dictatorial, but it was not in the interests of excessive consumption by elites. So whether that can be replicated or not, I'm not sure. But you're right. This is something that we have to think about. About population, I worry about that. I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
I want to thank Michael. We could go on for a while. You didn't sign a couple. All right, but Michael will be around for a few minutes out of
yeah,
the
Yeah, I'm happy to.
Questions. But right now, I'd just like to give a round of applause to Michael Blair.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I just say thank you very much for your good questions. You could see that there's a lot about all of this that's uncertain, and I'm struggling to figure all of this out as you are. So I really learned from and appreciated all of your questions and comments. So thank you very much.